All right, so this is the next revision of the ALSO protocol draft. Next slide. All right, so this is an outline of what we plan to talk about today. So first I'll give a basic overview of the protocol structure to refresh everybody. Then we'll talk about the protocol encoding, mostly as it's changed since the last IETF. We'll focus on the major discussion points. Instead, if there's questions about like specific parameters or that kind of stuff, certainly feel free to bring them up. But I think the goal is to focus on the major questions we need to answer in order to produce the next version of the draft. And then when we get into the more the smaller details, we can certainly explore those a lot more. Then open discussion at the end for other issues that you've seen that we haven't explicitly called out here. All right, so the basic concepts is a quick 2-minute overview. We have these things called network locations. These can either be individual endpoints. We also allow PIDs to basically name a group of endpoints. This is for both privacy and scalability reasons. And there's basically two entities that are contained in an ALSO server and that are the way to express policy. There's the network map, and this is basically the map between endpoints and their PIDs, basically the map for aggregations done in the network. And there's also a cost map, and this is going to expose the preferences by the ALSO server. And this is can be either costs between PIDs, or they can be costs between endpoints themselves. And we all, in the protocol, we also allow an ALSO server to define multiple types of costs. Next slide. So this is the overall protocol structure. We have basically two required services. One is the server capability. This gives basic information about the ALSO server itself. What other services does it support? What types of costs? And other types of other information that's global to the server itself. There's the map service, which exports which provides the network and cost maps to be downloaded by ALSO clients. And there's a number of other services that are built on top of the map service. One is the map filtering service, which allows ALSO clients to query for subsets of the maps. And there's also endpoint property service, which this is quite related to the provision of bandwidth discussion. But it also gives the ability to query for certain properties of an endpoint itself. And one of the properties we define is a PID. So you can basically figure out which aggregation a certain endpoint belongs in. The last one is endpoint cost service. You might have noticed we changed the name from ranking service to endpoint cost service. This basically gives cost information between endpoints themselves. And an endpoint cost service reflects this more than ranking service than the name ranking service. Next slide. All right. So this is the overall approach that we gave towards doing the protocol encoding. First is we want to provide an easy integration path. So this encompasses both using existing infrastructure, such as HTTP caches, hopefully maybe even web servers themselves. And also leverage the fact that many P2P clients have an HTTP client built in already. One of the design choices we made was to use text encoding to help make it easier to understand and debug and those nice properties. So we basically tried to do a RESTful interface over HTTP, and the other design choice made thus far was use JSON for the encoding. Next slide. All right, so this is the basic request syntax for ALSO requests. So we have basically the HTTP method and the URI path. This is going to encode to the ALSO server what operation are you trying to do. And the input parameters, depending on what operation you're doing, those are either in the query string or in the body itself. Currently, we try to use the query string where possible. And for example, if you're just giving a certain Boolean value to the ALSO server, we can use the query string. If you're trying to give either structured information or a list of or a list of things that can have a large length, we put those in the body itself. Next slide. All right, for the response, we currently have the HTTP, the response, the error code or success code is using the HTTP status code. There was some discussion on the list about adopting another status code in the application body, in application layer error code in the, for example, in the response body. And these would be cleanly separated. They should cleanly separate the roles of these two status codes. For example, the status code for, such as server overloaded or something would still remain faithful to could still be at the HTTP level. Information such as I don't have information about that prefix can be in the application the application layer in the response body itself. The overall response, the body of it, is a single JSON object. There's basically three pieces of information. At first is what we call the meta section, which is information about information that is not response, that has fields that are not response specific. So by that we mean things like the protocol version number or other information that basically applies to any Alto response. We have the type field, and this indicates which type of Alto information is encoded in the rest of the body. And the data section actually carries the actual Alto information. So the data section is a JSON object, and the formatting of it is going to be dependent on the actual type of Alto information. So for example, a cost map is going to have a different structure than a network map, or a list of, a list of endpoints and their properties is also going to have a different structure. And the overall design that we tried to keep here is to make the Alto response itself very self-contained. So, for example, if you were to just persist the body of this response, and you were to save it to disk, you could reload it at a later point and not have to store much extra, hopefully not to store any additional information later, or that you would also need to persist along with it. You can just store the object itself and read it later. All right, so now this is getting into some of the areas we'd also like some more feedback on, too, from members of the working group. So the current approach that we took to protocol versioning is to allow a single logical Alto server to implement a single protocol version. So this is somewhat different than other approaches that had been taken. So in a lot of REST implementations, you'll see such as the beginning of the path will encode the version number. So there was one of the things that we were concerned about there was the implications of the server discovery. So let's say you have an Alto client who understands version 1, and they need to find another Alto server that also supports version 1. We took the approach that you can basically find any Alto server, and then you get a list of other servers that will meet your needs. In this case, basically also support the same protocol version. So the way it is done, if you want to have a single Alto server, like a physical server that implements multiple versions, you use a solution such as virtual hosting. And the benefit is an Alto client can basically bootstrap from any Alto server. So there's a schematic at the bottom, and the physical Alto server can demultiplex the request based on the host name that's supplied. Is there any other comments on this approach, or? Yes.
Sure. This is certainly one option, but another option you might want to consider that's also done in many RESTful applications is to do version based on document content types. So if there really is, a lot of flexibility can be kept within a document type, but if there really is a disruptive change which requires a new format and just can't plug it into the old one, then give it a new content type. And again, you can have either one physical Alto server that can serve up, sure, I can serve you old version, or I can serve you new version, or it could do a redirect to the new version if it only understood the old stuff, or vice versa.
Okay. Sounds good.
And another architecture note is that giving servers the most control that you can over their namespace is a really good idea, and that includes query strings.
Okay.
Unless they're true queries, which starts to impinge on performance, if they can be modeled as path elements instead of as orthogonal queries, then for some servers that will be much better. And of course, some servers can choose query strings. Sometimes it just doesn't matter. But it does. The server's in the best position to know whether it matters for their architecture and their cacheability infrastructure and stuff like that.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, next slide if there's... All right, so this is an overview of the different services and operations that we currently have in the protocol and the basically the paths that we've defined for each one. I probably won't go through all of them, but note that we basically have five different services. The required map services under map/core, map filtering is under map/filter, endpoint property, there's two different versions of this. One is just a simplified version if you want to get a particular property for a single endpoint. And that's basically the simplified version of the more general. We're using a POST request where you can supply a list of endpoints and you want to get property and you want to get a certain property value about each one or a certain set of property values. Endpoint cost service, you basically feed it. You basically post a list of the source location, network location, basically, and the destination network locations, and the Alto server will reply with the cost between each pair of source and destinations. Next slide. All right, so I'll go into a little more detail about the server capability queries. I think this is one of the this is where a few of the interesting discussion questions arise. So just to refresh, the purpose of the server capability query is basically discover information about the server itself, but one of the other things that we're doing here currently is to also discover other Alto servers that might be useful to the client. So I'll walk through a little bit of the example here first, and then there's a few discussion questions that would be useful. So... you can see in this, we basically have two sections to the response here. The first, we have the server list, and this is a JSON array, and each element describes a single Alto server. So it gives the URI for the server, the version that it supports, a list of the services that it supports, and the different cost types. And there's also a separate section for information about the server itself that is not dependent or does not influence the Alto client's selection of an Alto server. So there's a few questions here. One is, should we actually be overloading the server capability query to do basically second stage of discovery? The other thing to think about here is how much configuration about a server are we actually going to put in this list? The reason that one of the advantages of putting more information there is the Alto client can now basically look at the list and do one decision saying, that's the Alto server that I want. It has exactly the configuration that I need. The drawback is that from the operator's point of view, if they want to make sure that all this configuration information is consistent across the set of Alto servers that they may have, it may be more hassle to update to make sure you have the same consistent configuration information across servers. The other point is, what do we need to do for different cost types? Do we actually need to develop a registry for these? And if so, what kinds of information do we need to put in there? So is there any other comments about those or...
Martin.
Yes.
One way of not having like a list of alternate servers would be that you use like an entry server who is redirecting you to the next available server on whatever metric.
So the other thing to consider is that it's not only an issue of availability, it's a matter of which one supports the configuration that... So for example, in a deployment, you might have one server that provides the map service that's really good at handling... that doesn't have, like, for example, it might not have a lot of CPU to process dynamic queries or something like that. So you might have one server providing static maps, you might have another one that is available for...
But I guess this also can handle with the regular HTTP redirect. If you make like a get server name network map, then this one tells you go to whatever else server. That's another possibility. No idea which is better.
Okay. That's another possibility for this.
I have a different question because there's this self-certificate information.
Yes.
Does it need to be a certificate per server? Or would it go to say, well, you get a certificate which is valid for all the information you get from whatever server you get it?
So this is another discussion. I think I was talking with Vijay in the hallway at one point, and he suggests, and the other possibility here is you might have a single certificate that's valid for a cluster of Alto servers. So one possibility here is instead of providing a single certificate, you or the certificate itself, you provide a URL where you can go get the certificate.
Okay.
There is also a draft making its way in the apps area on how to encode identities of servers and certificates, which might also be interesting to look at to answer if you want one certificate or you want multiple certificates. But the specific conversation we had was accessing a certificate, you could either send it from the server to the client or you could provide a URL of the kind we did in RFC 4475, or was it 74? 74.
I mean, the only other thing I'd mention briefly about that, not to make this any more complicated than it needs to be, is that, of course, there's a bunch of very smart people sitting around these days trying to figure out how to define the certification hierarchy for IP address blocks. And, I mean... Right. That you can slice this problem that way, too. I mean, what does it really mean? In other words, when you talk to a server, what information are you hoping to get from it? What kinds of assertions we want to make? And are we making them about blocks? And how do we imagine if you would be authorized to provide this information? And I mean, so it really does, I think, beg a whole broader set of questions about what really the security implications of it are.
Right. So to partially answer that, I think, in this context, the certificate would be used for basically signing the information for redistribution. So, for example, the Alto server will basically encode its public key in there, which would be used to sign the information that would be redistributed, and other Alto clients will be able to fetch the certificate too. Or sorry, use its private key to sign it, and then get other people can get the public key from the certificate and validate it.
And actually, this would vote for that. It's not the server certificate, because if you have like two servers, one is giving you the network map, the other the cost map. It would be better if you have like, or I don't know, zone certificate.
Right.
Sure. Yes.
Yeah. That was my point. So it's
okay.
Yeah.
Song Haibin from Huawei. I have a question. And if a domain has to add a new auto server. Or the information of the alternative auto server has been changed. Does it have the information has to be updated in this auto server?
Mm-hmm.
And it means some interoperation between the auto servers is needed, right?
Either that, or the provider can basically provision a new. Like configuration to each Alto server, or update the configuration on each one. It doesn't necessarily have to be an inter-Alto server protocol, but that's one of the trade-offs here, is if we put more information in the server list itself, for example, which services are supported at each server, it means you can do a one-shot discovery at which Alto server is right for you. Or if you put less information there, you only put a URI in each one, then for like per server configuration changes, you don't have to tell everybody else. Right? But if you in your use case where you're spinning up a new Alto server, then you would have to add it to at least the server list for another one.
Yeah, the information has to be synchronized.
Yes, but it doesn't have to be synchronized across every single one, right? Depending on where you're putting it and what, and who you want, which Alto clients you want to be able to find it.
Oh, is it better to have a separate auto discovery mechanism than independent of the auto protocol itself to do such things?
So that's one other way to do it. But one of the concerns there is that it depends on how the server discovery is implemented. So if you need to encode other information in the server discovery, which is basically the version that a certain server supports, the services, other information, then that might be hard depending on the discovery mechanism. So I think that's another option. And I guess it's one of the points of the discussion was to make sure that we evaluate the different trade-offs of each one. All right, I guess there's no other questions or comments, so. Next slide. All right, so the changes to the other remaining services were pretty minor, with the exception of that we added some specific encoding for each one. As I mentioned before, we renamed ranking service to endpoint cost service, since that more accurately characterizes what it does. For the other services, I was trying to avoid going in detail through the specifics and codings of each one because basically the operations that they perform is basically the same as we presented in the last IETF, except now we have real JSON encoding for each one. So if anybody has specific comments or questions about them, we can certainly field them now. Otherwise, we'll go on to some of the other discussion points. Yes?
Going back to the earlier question I had, is also for the structure, is there a way to validate the structure? Oh.
Sorry.
Okay, sorry. In terms of the structure validation, I like the idea to use JSON because of its inherent advantages over XML. But in terms of validating the structure, how will the client, Alto-client aspect that is receiving the message, would validate without having to rely on reflection?
So do you mean, so we don't have the equivalent of a DTD here, right? So is that what you're talking about, or?
Well, I was wondering if you had considered a dual approach where you would have the actual structure captured in an XML schema and then have an optional mapping to JSON so that clients that want to take advantage of that can leverage that. Because there are other advantages. Okay. If, let's say, you're making a cost map query, you have 32,000 routes come in, and if there's a CSR system that just wants to capture a particular view of that message, XML is a lot more mature to capture that. Even in aspects of signing, there are already standards around that, whereas JSON is maturing fast, but it's not there yet.
So this is something that I'm not as familiar with, but are there tools that convert between that do this conversion already, or is this something that would have to be newly specified?
Right. I have implemented the Alto client already based on the O2 spec when there was some indication that the final structure would perhaps be either XML or JSON.
Right.
And if you pick up even the Jersey client implementation off of the base Java tool, there are actually aspects built into it. And in fact, since 06, there are certain normalization techniques, Badgerfish is one of them, that describes how you can pick an XML message and convert it into JSON. So what that does is that it enables you to capture a more richer grammar through XML, but if, let's say, you have a better trust relationship between the Alto client and an Alto server, then effectively you can just rely on JSON without having to worry about the added overhead, if there is a concern, though I have other opinions that do not apply here in this audience.
So is there a standard conversion from XML to JSON, or is it because
it's not standard, okay. But given where we stand at the moment in the protocol, I mean, the only way the client can validate whether if it is receiving a well-formed message is to really take a peek at the protocol document. So, right, if there's a missing entity in that metadata that is, proposed,
yes.
Unless, if it is missing, you have to peek into the message to figure that out.
Right. So, you're right. In the current, I guess you could argue that this is good or bad because you could put other information there that the client just has to figure out that the information it needs is in there, right? It can ignore everything else, right?
Right.
And
it could be at the 23,000 row down if you're picking up a cost map. So that's a disadvantage. The other thing is that there are techniques being developed on JSON to do things that are equivalent to XPath and XSLT to do the transformation and present that graph into the GUI. But again, they're not standard yet.
Okay.
Right? So, and some other aspects while I'm at it is, for instance, if let's say there are localized policies that the ISPs want to apply to extend this behavior and the extension is mentioned in the current requirements document, then obviously XML gives you a way to do that by leveraging the namespace in support of any and other namespaces. I can claim ignorance on this matter on JSON unless somebody knows. I don't think there's a standard approach to do that.
Okay. So actually, one of the things that might be useful is if you could if you can point or send a message to the list that points to these different conversions and what the benefits of applying each one would be. I think one of the things that we want to keep in mind here is we still want it to be simple in the common case, right?
Right.
As opposed to requiring an Alto client to do a number of other conversions in case they needed to do some sort of validation.
Right. This is a very worthwhile point. I totally agree. And based on our implementation, I think there is such an opportunity where you can have the best of both worlds, because inherently we're not dealing with very large data sets here. And the protocol itself is also very simple, where unlike SAML or other federated protocols that are out there, it's not as rich where it creates a burden where you have to do the conversion from XML to JSON. So if we are going to give an option to use JSON, I think we can do that without creating too many issues.
Okay.
But yeah, I can certainly go ahead and comment on the list if that helps.
Yeah, that would be great. And then we can, other people can basically give their feedback on whether certain capabilities are needed in the protocol or which ones would be nice to have and what the best way to go about it would be.
Sounds good. Thanks.
Right.
For the note takers, the speaker was Syed Ali. Right.
All right, next slide. It probably makes sense to spend that. We have 5 minutes. Probably makes sense to spend that on V4, V6.
5 minutes.
Okay. So why don't we, the more fruitful discussion to have would probably be IPv4 versus IPv6. So let's skip the redistribution stuff for now and then go to V4 versus V6. Right. So as Ronaldo alluded to, we have to do we have to make some decisions when it comes to supporting both IPv4 and IPv6 from the Alto server. So right now in the protocol document, it makes no statement about how we're going to approach this. So what we're doing is we're basically looking for feedback from the working group about what kinds of what the best way to do this is. One of the first questions I think we need to answer is what preferences need to be conveyed when it comes to IPv4 versus IPv6. Then after we figure out what kinds of preferences need to be conveyed, then we can talk about what the best way to implement it is. So one of the first discussion questions probably is what granularity do you need to convey preferences about IPv4 versus IPv6? So for example, one simple possibility is there's a global preference for every client of a single Alto server, they always prefer contacting destination hosts over versus v6 if possible, and second, and if that's not available, then choose IPv4. A simple technique for doing that might be just give a ranking of I prefer these types of endpoint identifiers, then I prefer these other ones if they're available, etc. Do these preferences need to be conveyed, for example, per destination network location? So, for example, if you're a certain ISP and you have two peers, ISP A and ISP B, then if there's a preference that you should use IPv6 in ISP A and v4 when you're contacting people in ISP B, then basically per destination location dependent preferences for v4 versus v6. So I guess we're looking for feedback here about what kinds of, or other preferences that might be available or desired, what kinds of things are you looking to convey when it comes to preference for v4 and v6?
Hi. So I think this is the type of thing, instead of going directly into the technicality of it, you would benefit to have a few use cases, right?
Right.
I mean, and kind of a top-down approach where these are the use cases, you know. There's a lot of documentation around that about how people are going to deploy this kind of transition networks. So, okay, I have this private network, where the alt is going to sit, et cetera. And then after we go about this kind of a use cases, you know, or maybe get the top two. And then we can feed that back into the protocol to say, this is how we think it's going to work, as opposed to go from a bottom-up approach and find out that maybe it doesn't really address what network operators want for their network.
Yeah, I think that's exactly what we're looking for here, is we're trying to go that approach instead of saying, you must encode the network map this way. We're trying to figure out what you really want conveyed for your network.
Dave Crocker. From one perspective, this topic of V4, V6 preferences is perfect for this activity. From a different perspective, I'm not sure that there's anything different here with all of the other activities that just still have to decide between V4, V6 choices. And I guess that leads to my wondering whether there's aspects of that are specific here, which is one possibility, whether this is the group that should figure out the answer for the rest of the groups, but at a minimum that there should be some kind of coordination. And related to somehow to all of this is whether this particular question is really different from any of the other kinds of route choice questions that the group is trying to answer. This is just another attribute that might affect which path you prefer, or which target host you'd want to choose.
Right. So for the second one in particular, the reason that I think it's important is because the point that we choose in the solution space might impact how complicated these maps end up getting in terms of conveying those preferences. If we were to choose the very simple, always choose IPv6 if possible, then maybe we don't have to specify anything. We just put a requirement in the document or something, or a note in the document. If it comes to, you should a provider has a choice of type of identifier only, then that just might be a single, very easy to put in the protocol itself. If it comes down to per network location or per endpoint, we have to do a lot more work in terms of how to encode that in these network maps or cost maps.
Are you seeking to have this group possibly make the decision that V6 shall always be preferred, as an example? I mean,
that's just one point in the design space. I don't think if that's what I'm not suggesting that is the answer or not, but that was
trying to understand was whether you're raising the question that, because you, as soon as you said potential simplification versus complexity,
right,
is if the group decides the answer is always choose V6 or always choose V4, whatever,
yeah,
but always choose, then the map gets simpler, but maybe that's not so good.
Right.
And if it is good, why isn't that right for everybody else?
Right.
Well, I was trying to understand what the goal that you had in mind here.
Right. So for this, I mean, I guess the two examples here are, And for example, if you have a global preference for the provider gets to choose, I will always want IPv4, or I always want IPv6. The provider gets to choose it. We're not deciding it as a working group. But
So your thought was, here's another attribute to allow specification for,
yes,
and the whoever's operating their particular announcements will decide what level of complexity they want.
Yes, or okay. And also what level of complexity we allow in the protocol, because it's kind of depending on what preferences you're. But
see, now you just moved right into the, because if you don't allow the complexity, then you've forced some of the preferences and excluded some others, and that's what I was trying to understand what the goal was.
Yeah, it's to identify how simple we can make it while conveying what is needed to providers.
How do you determine what's needed?
Presumably, we can ask people what they would need for their networks, right? So if the world is all IPv6, we don't have this discussion anyways, right?
So this, yeah, and in 20 or 30 years, that would be really good to do.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, but yeah, if we allow for all the possible flexibility, the concern here is that we might end up having a very complicated encoding for this, or a complicated way to specify how you should interpret these network maps.
Hi, this is Jeff Mattson from Huawei. And I think you're opening up a very large can of worms here, really.
Yes.
Right? You have to talk about V6, but then you also really do have to think about transition mechanisms as well.
Yes.
And other forms of interaction. And pretty soon you do have some sort of generic endpoint identifier. And I think I see your point in wanting to avoid the complexity, but unfortunately I don't think that's really possible.
Right. Right?
I think you could default to V4 maybe, but if you open up to V6, you have to open up to these other forms of endpoints.
Right.
And there's no avoiding it.
Right.
We're out of time after we reach the line is cut. Okay.
This is Rich Wondi. I think it's good to have this kind of functionality. I can already imagine scenarios in which a client thinks that they have IPv6 connectivity because they have a V6 address, but what's really happening is they're behind a NAT64 device or something else like that, and it's only the operator on the far side that knows that there's only a V4 network. And if you actually try to use V6 as the primary mechanism in that particular case, it may be suboptimal. Vice versa, it could be the case that with one of these transition mechanisms, the operator is offering V4 but only a NATed V4, whereas it could allow a completely native V6. And so having the ability to, at least for the network provider, to provide some assistance to the client to say, hey, you know, I for your case, I think I'd recommend V4, or hey, I think I'd recommend V6. Even though both of them might work, there might actually be some benefit to both the client and the ISP.
Right.
Any comments on this?